I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and it's time for some ASAP Frontline. Today, we are talking with a guest that's returning to the show, one of my favorite folks with regards to the pediatric emergency medicine world, Dr. Marianne Gauci-Hill. You've heard her on the podcast in the past, one of the great educators in the PZM world, and today we're going to talk about the Pediatric Readiness Project. With regard to, is your emergency department ready to take care of critical care pediatric patients? If yours is like mine, community setting, you know, for me, a pediatric emergency department just down the road, about a mile and a half or so. And so we don't deal with a lot of critical care pediatric patients, but we do deal with some on occasion. In an emergency medicine, no matter where you are, having that red emergency department outside your hospital, outside your department, you're going to occasionally get really sick kids. And the goal of this project is to kind of get an idea and the tools necessary to make sure that you are ready to take care of the lion's share of resuscitation efforts for the pediatric patient when they present to the ER. And this is especially important if you're a smaller ED or a community ER where you don't do a lot of it. When you have one come in, it tends to be a surprise, tends to be a crashing child. And at that point, it's really tough to be trying to put everything together and find everything at any given moment. So, Dr. Gauci-Hill, thanks for joining us here on the front line and give us a little background on the project.
So the National Pediatric Readiness Project is a multi-phase quality improvement initiative sponsored by American College Emergency Physicians, American Academy of Pediatrics, Emergency Nurses Association, and the Federal Emergency Medical Services for Children Program as part of Maternal Child Health and Health Resources Services Administration. And so 8 years ago, we had our first web-based assessment, and 83% of all the emergency departments in the United States responded. So what is the purpose? The purpose is really, there's multifold. One is to, you know, get a snapshot of pediatric readiness at this time, and that helps to drive efforts at each particular hospital. So what will happen, all of the current leadership in hospitals have received a letter which asks them to participate in the National PEDS Ready program, okay? And their state EMS for Children program managers who will be emailing those non-respondents to encourage them to respond. And the benefit to the hospitals is you get an immediate score after you do it, and that tells you how you're doing. It's a scores normalized 0 to 100. And it tells you, it gives you a gap report. It gives you your score, how you do compared to like hospitals, meaning with similar pediatric volumes, and then also how you are doing compared to everybody who has submitted a score. And then it gives you a gap analysis. What are the things that you're missing? We encourage people, any ED could be fully pediatric ready as based on guidelines, the national policy statement from all of those three sponsoring organizations, ENA, ASAP, and AAP. We're encouraging all EDs to contribute to it. And there's a lot of real benefits to contributing, both just for the individual and the hospital itself to help drive quality improvement measures, but also it provides a big database that can be utilized and leveraged by researchers to really evaluate some of the factors that might help improve readiness, access to care, those kinds of things. So it's exciting when you get such a large data set like we got in 2013 with over 4,000 emergency departments responding. And probably the from that, the kind of the holy grail of developing policy is that you actually make a difference to the patient, right? And so with the those EDs with the highest quartile of readiness have 4 times lower mortality for children with critical illness. And that was published in Pediatrics. And there's emerging data to suggest that that's true for trauma as well. So it's kind of a nice way. You know, people always ask me, what do I do? You know, what are the things I need, you know, in my emergency department to help me do a better job to care for children? And really the readiness guidelines, the guidelines help you identify that. And there's some tools at pediatricreadiness.org. There's a whole toolkit. There's a checklist. There's an interactive checklist where you can click on to get the resources. So kind of one-stop shopping. And so the idea is, let's find out where you sit. What are the things you need to do to improve? And then you just initiate your own quality improvement. This is, program.
You were talking about kind of the overview of the project. And you mentioned in there that the upper quartile has a significant lower mortality rate associated with pediatrics. And it really kind of seems like it boils down to the key here with the toolkit and everything else is you don't know what you don't know. And so what is it that about PEDS readiness and the difference in these quartiles that increases risks risk to the pediatric patient?
Well, I think that those who are in the highest quartile have all the equipment, policies in place. You know, they weigh children and document in kilograms as an example, which we know is a patient safety issue. There are things like having policies for abnormal vital signs. I think one of the biggest things that I would say might separate out the highest quartile from lower quartiles would be the assignment of the role of a physician and nurse pediatric emergency care coordinator. We know from previous work that just assigning the role, it doesn't mean that they have to be a PEDS-EM doc or it is assigning the role of a physician and nurse coordinator to look at issues to make sure that your ED certainly has equipment, policies in place, and processes to care for children, that assignment alone improves the likelihood that you integrate children in your quality improvement plan, that you have a disaster plan that includes children, that you have policies related to abnormal vital signs or what have you. That assignment alone is really actionable by any ED in the United States.
Well, that's it sounds like though that with that, with even just assigning the role, that basically it's just the awareness of saying that we want to see this as a separate entity other than just general emergency care, and just saying, well, we'll be able to do that. I think one of the biggest challenges that most emergency departments face, and I've actually heard it in my own, not the current one where I am, but the ones I've worked in the past, is we're not a pediatric hospital. We don't do pediatrics. Now, how does just that mindset just set you up for failure with regard to pediatric care, with the thought that we just don't do peds?
Everybody does peds because they'll walk in, right? The large majority of children. So only about 10% are brought in by EMS, and the rest are, walk-ins. And parents tend to go to the hospital within their community, right? You don't want to drive long distances. The way I look at it is every ED has the opportunity to improve their pediatric readiness, right? Because you're going to see kids one way or the other. You may not see a lot. We know that the average ED sees less than 13 kids a day. So for any one practitioner to have a lot of experience, it's relatively low. So what are the things that you need to help you do the best job you can? One would be having the appropriate policies in place. The other is really having a good understanding about stabilization and secondary transfer. So how do you smooth that out? You know, I think we see a lot of interfacility transfer with kids, right? So you want to do what you need to do for resuscitation, and then you need to really hone down that process for secondary transfer and build those relationships with regional pediatric centers that do have inpatient resources in order to really optimize the care of the child.
Looking at the toolkit, about 60 to 70%, that's just a guess, rough guess, 2.5 of the 4 pages of the checklist, it really is looking at the supplies that you need, you know, looking at appropriate tubes, appropriate mm-hmm. LP trays, central line access, things of that nature. And I still recall looking through the supplies at my original facility when I finished residency, and things hadn't been updated. You know, packets, things that had been packaged in 1984. and ensuring things that were up to date. You know, of course, 1984, you still had some of the metal syringes, some of the, you know, the glass measuring vials. I mean, everything was, you know, everything like you'd see in a museum. And, you know, a lot of times emergency departments will buy this stuff, and it is going to be, it's going to be a very low use, high impact items. I mean, we're talking about pediatric airway. Mm-hmm. You know, the chances, I've at my current facility, which is a community emergency department with a pediatric hospital just a mile down the road, I've had one pediatric arrest in the 8 years that I've been there, that I've worked with. And as you mentioned, it wasn't one brought in via EMS. It was one that the family brought in the child, presented, you know, to the front for triage, and the child coded in triage. And, you know, that readiness was key, that it may, a lot of it may expire over time, but the understanding that we don't need to have tens and thousands of these devices and items, but, you know, having them available. And I think one of the big important aspects of it is if it's a low frequency event. So for us, pediatric resuscitation is incredibly rare. Yeah. We're going to see a lot of pediatrics, but, you know, lacerations, falls, general illness, typical stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not typically emergent or unstable, but with the low use but high impact items, a lot of it is, the key is the organization,
right?
Because if people in the hospital or in the emergency department don't know where it is, it's in the, most people know where all the adult stuff is because we're there all the time getting stuff and mm-hmm. and getting supplies and doing things. So having a pediatric cart or something with that organization, what are some of those key take homes that you have for places that are super low frequency pediatric critical care, but at the same time, by having that red sign, that emergency department out front, you have that opportunity to have a very sick kid roll up at any point, and usually with less notification than you would get, say, at a pediatric facility where they do more often pediatric resuscitation.
Absolutely. I think keeping things organized, I think you just hit the nail on the head. You know, it's like you have a specific spot for your equipment, especially you have your resuscitation room. You typically take kids. I worked in a community hospital that was pretty low in terms frequency of the number of really critical children, just like what you described, Ryan. So I just made sure that we had a bag mask device at every location. And then short of that, you could bring in the cart, which has everything else, right? And if you organize it by weight or color zone, if you wanted to use either any of the length-based resuscitation tape or the Braslow tape, you know, anything like that. I have nothing to disclose, by the way. But I think using those to help organize your equipment is really fantastic. So either by color zone or weight class, I think that's really helpful. I want to say two other things one of the things that's, it's tough for any one individual to have that experience in dealing with critically ill or injured patients, even, you know, so let's talk about what you can do about that. One is you empower yourself with tools at hand that can help you do a better job, such as pre-calculating all the drug dosing, right, based on your formulary, that you can work with pharmacy. Two is that you have the length-based tape to estimate weight. A lot of people use gurney weights now in kilos. Three is that you can seek continuing education through the various professional organizations to make sure that you're up to speed on latest issues related to pediatric resuscitation. And what I like to tell ER docs to do that are great resuscitators. They do, this is what we do, you know. We see somebody, they're sick, and we resuscitate them. But with children, you don't get a lot of practice. So I would say if you saw a two-year-old with otitis media, that you walk through the mental exercise of what you would do if they were in status epilepticus, cardiac arrest. What would you do? Where would you find the equipment? How would you dose them appropriately? What would be your first steps? And that way, if you just even did that once a shift with children of different age groups, I call that deliberate or cognitive practice, then you're kind of, you're ready to roll when a sick child comes in. So that's a suggestion. And the final suggestion I'll make is have a whole separate thing for newborns. When you deliver in the ED, you know, it's crazy, right? Things just move pretty quickly. So we developed a whole neonatal just resuscitation kit. You have your BOA kit, right? You want to dry, warm, stimulate. You do that. You want to be able to potentially get a line. How would you do that? Do you have your UVC catheter there? This is for emergency departments now. But have everything together. You know, the only time you'd ever use a small blade, like a zero blade and a 3-0 tube, right? And a neonatal bag, the only time you're going to use it if you birth the baby yourself or the baby's born just prior to arrival. Otherwise, you know, the infant sizes are going to be fine. So it's nice to collect that stuff together, and maybe on your infant warmer, that's where we store everything. So when the infant warmer is brought over to get ready to put the child on the infant warmer, that you have all your resuscitation supplies there. So that's just a hint for newborns.
Well, and what you're talking with Dr. Marianne Gauci-Hill, somebody's a guest we've had on the program, one of our go-tos for pediatric emergency medicine. And this is, you were talking, I was just thinking about my last three pediatric intubations. And in the community setting, there rarely is a warning. It usually just drops in your lap. You're like, oh, wow, we just went from zero to, oh, crap, in half a second. And, you know, the last three intubations was an acute respiratory failure in an asthma patient. But then one was a young lady who came in, didn't realize she was pregnant, said, I've got abdominal pain. I feel like I have the urge to push. And all of a sudden, a baby comes sliding out onto the bed. And you're like, oh. And then, you know, the other one was the arrest I was talking about in triage. And none of those were any that we had any warning prior to. And so, as you mentioned, with the delivery, you know, deliveries are often like that. It is a very narrow window where a delivery happens in most emergency departments. It's either goes to, it either delivers prior to arrival or makes it to some sort of OBGYN. Now, some communities, centers, facilities are going to have more often than others. But typically, it is a precipitous type delivery situation. And so you talked about it with your blanket warmer and having all the supplies there. I think that's some of the keys, is having that all bundled together, one source where we're not trying to educate in an emergent, urgent, frantic situation of trying to identify and put together everything wherever it may be. And so for us, we've got the cart. We do have the warmer and that aspect of it. But we have the cart as well that has everything already broken down by expected and average kilograms in age, and the tape is there, and it's we just open up and everything is in there. Now the key for a lot of places is making sure all that stuff's up to date, the batteries are charged, and everything is good to go. But it's not something where you can prepare when it happens. It's one of those things that the best outcomes are going to come because you are already prepared and ready for it. And though it may be 3 or 4 years before you use it or see it or need it, you know, it's one of those things. And that's exactly what this program is about. I mean, honestly, it's the name. You get the PEDS ready aspect of it. It's about, we don't want you to have to deal with it, not expect it, but it's going to happen. And that's actually, I got a call last night. I was talking to one of the physicians in the hospital. Her spouse was an outside and had somebody pulled up in a car, dropped off, who was a trauma, and had to do a trauma resuscitation intubation on a pediatric patient. And, you know, that's, they weren't a trauma center. They aren't a pediatric facility, but both of them happened, and both of them happened without warning. And so that's that importance of getting involved. And this one, the initial assessment is 21 pages. It's pretty extensive. Looking at all of the different things that you can look at, the checklist that we were talking about is a 4-page document that runs from, you know, basic preparedness, footprint, coordinators, weights, documentation, medications, supplies. It runs through all of that stuff. So really there isn't reinventing the wheel. It is more about, you know, just plug and play type stuff. There's nothing you have to think about other than the fact of, let's get it ordered and let's get it in place. What are some of the good take homes with initiation and why it's important for those places that, you know, may not see, they're not going to have a huge volume of pediatrics that, but you know, those are ones that's really targeted to. Why is it important for somebody to take the bull by the horns on this one and go after it?
Well, the key thing is everybody can do it. You just got to make the commitment to do it. And, you know, the bottom line is everybody wants to do the best job they can. Like, you don't show up to work going, yeah, I think, you know, I really want to screw up today while I'm at work. Nobody does that, right? Everybody's there to do the best job they can for no matter what age patient. And like you said, you don't get any warning. It just happens. So the key is you want to just prepare yourself, organize yourself. So if something does happen, you're ready to go. You know where to go. You know where to get the equipment. You pull it out. You know how to size the equipment because it's already pre-sized based on kilogram or age or however you do it, color zone. But as long as everybody understands that process, then they're empowered to really act and act when at time of need. And I think that's really key, Ryan. You know, I think you really nailed it when you said you just don't get any warning. So if you don't get any warning, do you really want to run from room to room to find stuff? The answer is no, you don't. But you go, bring the cart, but in every room I've got a bag mask. I'll start bagging this patient. Just bring the cart to me and let's do this. You know, that's how you would approach it. I will say that for hospitals of really low volume, you know, you don't need large numbers of this equipment. You brought that point up earlier, right? What do you need based on your own volume? And then as you use it, you exchange it out. And for those who are in healthcare systems, as an example, you might have a higher volume pediatric center and a lower volume. You could do some equipment exchange. I've heard of hospitals doing that within, you know, healthcare systems, right? So you have your higher volume peds hospital versus your lower volume, and you exchange them out as needed. And that would lower cost, but we haven't found cost as a barrier at all. It's less than 18 cents a visit to be pediatric ready. So my feeling is it's not a matter of cost. It's a matter of commitment and organization. And once you make that commitment, then honestly, everybody feels better about the process and feels more empowered to really take care of their patients.
So how do departments, one, get involved with the survey? And are these scores published, or is there anything that is used for or against a facility when they do the assessment?
First of all, we would like ED leadership, so the ED nurse manager, to work with the ED medical director, because during this time of the assessment, when we're really looking globally at the U.S., a hospital can only enter their data once. Once this has happened and we close the portal to do an analysis, which is really aggregate, so we're not publishing anybody's individual scores or anything like that. The individual scores that each hospital gets is secure to them, and it's really given to them to empower them to then act based on that gap analysis to improve their readiness. It's really to help them. Okay. And so we ask that ED leadership enter their data into the assessment at www.pedsready.org. Pedsready.org. It's behind me on my screen, but I don't think. Pedsready.org. And you'll get your score, again, like scores, so you can like hospitals, so you can benchmark yourself, and then how the rest of the nation is doing. And in addition, it's really cool. We have a live map, which shows states and states responding. And the goal would be to, I think, get involved, not only get your hospital, but get others around you to participate, because it's only going to help them improve their own readiness. And we'd like to beat our 83% from last time and get, you know, over 4,000 for sure EDs to respond, because then we really have an understanding, and considerable resources are brought to bear to address this issue by a number of professional organizations. So by a large number of people responding, we get an idea of where the gaps are, and then we can help by bringing resources to hospitals to help them do the best job possible.
And that's going to be integral that it's, you know, that one is de-identified data, so it's not going to be held against you. It's to use this as an opportunity to compare and see where you are of like-minded, similar type facilities. I mean, it's one of those things that's really nice to see that it's not, you know, I'm not comparing rural critical access to Kentucky to CHOP or Cincy Children's or whoever it may be. It's similar type facilities, similar type situations. And this isn't about having everything necessary to run kids from now through all of critical care on ECMO and everything about that. This is just basic pediatric readiness for general resuscitation efforts and assessment that we're going to need in the emergency department and almost any emergency department around the country. And there's a lot of opportunities on the website. I've been surfing the website, you know, while we've been on here looking at the survey as well as the tips and frequently asked questions. Is there any cost associated with it?
No, it's free. Everything's free. You know, I mean, participating in the assessment is free. And so when you look at cost benefit, it costs you nothing besides 20 to 25 minutes of your time. And then what you get out of it is really some great data to help you continue your pediatric readiness improvement efforts at your hospital.
As everybody says, and I mentioned earlier, you don't know what you don't know. And we don't want you to figure out that you don't know when there's a sick child sitting in front of you in your emergency department. So Dr. Couchy-Hill, how can folks get in touch with you? You mentioned the website, pedsready.org, pedsready.org. And thank you for putting that up behind you on the screen. And though the listeners can't see it, I can see it, and it makes it easy for me to read it right now. The assessment is open. When does the assessment close?
July, in the end of July. But again,
so we got a little bit.
Oh, we've got some time, so this is really, you know, good timing to talk with you, Ryan, on Frontline, just to get the word out so people know it's there.
So you got a little bit of time, but not enough that if you put this on the back burner too far that it'll slip by quickly, as I just figured out that we're already almost through May of 2021. When we just thought 2020 would never end, 2021 is getting close to the halfway mark. And once we get through that, this shall close relatively soon. Well, by the time we recording this wise, about 2.5 months, a little less than 2.5 months from now is when it closes out. How can folks get in touch with you if they have any more questions? And, you know, give us a little briefing talk up for the PEDS assembly. We missed it this year. I did some stuff earlier, did a recording. But what are we looking like for next year?
No, it's awesome because there is, a full day kind of soup to nuts pediatric emergency medicine, which is kind of one-stop shopping if you really want an update. And then the advanced assembly, which really helps push the envelope, you know, how do you answer some really important questions currently in pediatric emergency care. And so it's there's also, we've done skills as well. So there's an opportunity to have day skills to practice. So all of that it's a great place to meet and to meet your peers and talk about your experiences. So it's a wonderful conference. It's been over 10 years now, believe it or not. And we've just had a great following. So it's the ACEP's Advanced Pediatric Emergency Medicine Assembly. So good stuff.
And it tends to rotate between the New York and the two Disneys. I know we've been on a break for a couple of years from a live in-person at virtual that just happened about a month ago. And hopefully going to be back live and in person here very soon as we see meetings starting to get back together. I think it's a fantastic conference that combines the experts in pediatric emergency medicine, the people with just incredible expertise, but also incredibly engaging, wonderful speakers that are out there. So I've enjoyed it thoroughly, and that is definitely one that I would encourage for most people out there. And how can folks get in touch with you if they have more questions, thoughts, or want to advance further on this?
Yeah, I mean, you could email me, which would be great. And my email is long, but it's mgaushe-hill, at DHS, like Department of Health Services, DHS.LA County. Now you know where I live. dhs.lacounty.gov. So mgaoshi-hill@dhs.lacounty.gov. And I'm more than happy to communicate with anybody who has any questions about the assessment. And at PEDS Ready, there's also, you know, if anybody, there's frequently asked questions, and also there's contact information if you need to call somebody. So there's actually a group of us that are on call by text. And so if somebody has a question about the assessment, they actually text all of us and then we respond right away so that anybody who's doing the assessment doesn't feel they have to wait to get a response. So,
Dr. Gauthier is one of the very easiest to find online. So if you want to find her, you can Google Marion Gauthier. You look at a little PZM in there and you're going to, it's not one that you're going to get 500 different versions like you are. Well, even Ryan Stanton, you're not going to get two, but you are going to get two MDs. One's a plastic surgeon, one's an emergency physician. And then there's a hockey player, and I am neither of the others. So look her up, check it out, contact her. It's fantastic information. I appreciate you joining me once again here on the front line. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ryan. It's always great to be with you. Thanks.
As for me, you can contact me at rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org. Check us out on any of the platforms, subscribe to the podcast, weekly offerings for you, as well as check us out on Facebook, on the ASAP Frontline, or at Everyday Med on Twitter. Until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.